Carrying their belongings, Ruby and Mari followed their stepmother off the train onto frozen mud. The biting wind whipped Ruby's hair around. Her cheeks burned with cold. They trekked behind the others over ruts rigid with ice and passed a large sign painted in plain block letters, Jerome Relocation Center, and through the gate, where soldiers hoisted a U.S. flag and rendered military salutes. Winter gales sent the flag flapping. Ruby rubbed her arms, jumped around to get warm, and recalled her lessons on what the distinct colors of the flag represented. White for purity and innocence. Red for valor. Blue for perseverance, vigilance, and justice.
From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today, we'll be talking with Kent and Constance Hayes Matsumoto about their book, Of White Ashes, a World War II historical novel based on true events.
She jumped at the startling clang of the gate slamming behind them and her sudden realization the guards were there to keep them in, locked behind barbed wire fencing under freedom's flag. Standing on a line that stretched beyond her field of vision, she asked for bravery from any higher power who might hear her, and struggled to breathe the air that accentuated the flag's merciless taunts of freedom.
The reader meets Ruby Ishimaro and Koji Mitsuru, two youths separated by the Pacific. They meet in California and embark upon a life together in which they reconcile their past. Although White Ashes is a novel which alternates chapters, in this episode we'll focus on the Ruby Ishimaro sections.
As Connie was doing the research and would uncover these nuggets, she would ask me, did your father experience this? Did your mother experience that? Some were yes, some were no.
Inspired by true stories of Kent's family, Of White Ashes is a tale of resilience and a message of caution for future generations.
There had never been any proof of any single Japanese American or Japanese national, for that matter, on U.S. soil who had committed any kind of wrong against the United States.
Of White Ashes, on Arts and Letters. Constance Hayes Matsumoto and Kent Matsumoto, Of White Ashes, a novel that Lois Lowry says leaves the reader with a new awareness of history and a deep appreciation of the human heart. Welcome to Arts and Letters.
Thank you for your warm welcome, Brad, and we are delighted to be here.
Good morning, Brad. It's so nice to be here with you.
What would you say the book is about?
This book is really about two Japanese Americans who experience the worst of the war between America and Japan, and through it, really demonstrate the Japanese cultural value of gamon, which is a spirit of moving through difficult times with grace and dignity.
What we also feel is important is that the book conveys the feelings. What must it have felt like to experience a bomb that nobody in the world had ever experienced before? What must it have felt like to be taken from Hawaii and moved to Jerome, Arkansas, of all places?
The book begins in 1939 when Ruby, who is Kent's mom's character, is 10 years old, living on the island of Kauai in Hawaii with her family. Her father is a Buddhist minister. And Koji, who is the character reflected as Kent's dad, who is living in militaristic Japan, and he doesn't know that he's an American citizen. And so it begins with each of them alternating chapters. And it's not until about 1949 that the stories come together.
Tell us a little bit about where it came from.
The idea for this book was inspired on our first date. Kent and I were at the Baltimore Museum of Art for a Dale Chihuly glass exhibit. And the precursor exhibit was a photography exhibit by Dorothea Lange. I was standing there looking at this photograph of a little Japanese American girl wearing her very cute coat with a tag around her neck, holding a suitcase, waiting to get on a bus with her family to go to camp. And Kent came up behind me and said, that was my mother's story. And I got shivers at that point. Then later in the day, he shared his father's story with me, that his father, also an American citizen, was a Hiroshima survivor. And I thought that was truly remarkable, that two people who had experienced really the worst of the Japanese-American experience of World War II had found each other, had come together, and had birthed this human being who I was having lunch with.
For my mother's side of the family, she was one of four girls born to my grandfather and his first wife. No son, no person to carry on the family name. My mother never talked about that, at least not to me. So I don't know how that really affected her or affected the family dynamics in her household. For the record, I am the oldest son of my father. I have a younger sister and then a brother 2 years younger than that. My parents had always been wonderful parents. All of us adore my parents for not only who they were, not only for what they accomplished, but for all that they went through for us.
You both are married. What was it like to write this together?
For us, it was pretty effortless. We work well together in all facets of our life, and the book is just another example of how well we work together. Connie took the lead. It just grew organically.
We first approached his parents with the idea of having a nonfiction author draft their story. They were warm to the idea, and then they changed their minds. A year or so later, we had an opportunity to meet a documentary filmmaker who was interested in developing this story. Again, Kent's parents were somewhat interested, then they nixed the idea pretty quickly.
Do you have a sense of why they wanted to do it and then they pulled back?
I go back to a more common, broader theme of the trauma. The trauma of having experienced a bomb explode over your head, having experienced being an American citizen and spending 4 years of your life behind barbed wire. They didn't know how long they were going to be there. It could be a year, could be 5 years, could be 20 years. And so it's that uncertainty that is also very traumatic.
They really did want to do it, but then when it came time to go for it, it probably scared them a little bit.
I think you're right. My mother, in her later years, self-published a number of children's graphic novels. They're her way of expressing to the world. She also took the time to talk with Connie about the family history.
Many years before she died, she had put together a binder for Kent and his brother and his sister with family photos and a narrative about her life's experiences. Just a treasure trove of family documents and articles and books that had been very important to the two of them about Hiroshima, about the reconstruction of Hiroshima, and about the Japanese-American incarceration.
My parents, through their adult lives before their 80s, really did not talk about the war years much, if at all. We would ask questions here and there, but I wasn't that interested either. I was too busy being a kid. And I think my parents preferred it that way. They wanted to protect us from the trauma that they had each experienced.
This book is seeded in a lot of trauma, and there's a trauma right from the beginning.
Ruby sat alone, distracted and indignant at not being allowed to stay home for the birth. A good student, she was often the first to raise her hand. Not today. She fidgeted all throughout arithmetic and spelling. Instead of following the text during reading, she gazed at the alphabet written in her teacher's flawless cursive on the blackboard, and baby names flowed through her imagination. The sharp lines of K for Kenzo, the graceful strokes of M for Marguerite, the simple curve of C for Chico, her father's given name. Her gaze drifted through the cracked window to endless miles of sugarcane in the distant hills and back to the schoolyard where the crooked trunk of a kiwi tree stood. She daydreamed about teaching her new baby brother or sister not to touch its thorns and hoped the baby wasn't hurting her mother.
Ruby's mother does not survive the childbirth, nor does the baby girl, as it turns out, and it sets in motion a number of events.
This throws Ruby's world into chaos. She had not experienced anything like this, losing your mother at such a young age. Let's talk about Ruby's father. People deal with grief in so many different ways, and it seems to profoundly affect him.
Father's voice was steady and his face impassive as he concluded the service with words of appreciation. My wife, Akemi, was a lovely woman. Her life was full of good deeds, and she was well loved by our family and you, our friends. She was soft-spoken and patient. She loved and cared. My heart is grateful she came here with me to this land of promise. Now she's gone, and we will miss her. As a Buddhist, she moved with grace toward her death with every breath. She and our baby daughter will be reborn in the Pure Land.
He was brokenhearted. She was the love of his life. But yet he had responsibilities. That was his priority. The temple that he was responsible for was his priority. And figuring out a way to care for his four daughters was his responsibility. He really needed to put the grief aside. There's also the religious component. He was a Buddhist minister, and he really believed in the fragility of life. That life shouldn't be taken for granted. That really is where the title of the book comes from. The title Of White Ashes was inspired by the Buddhist writings on white ashes, which is often read at funerals. Kent and I heard it for the first time at his mom's funeral. And the writing basically says that one can be born and have radiant health in the morning and be only of white ashes at the end of the day. And that was his belief system. This is to be expected. Life is very fragile. Life happens. Death happens.
Outside the temple doors, Ruby stood in a daze next to Madi and their father as he greeted the mourners. Nothing felt real. She heard Father thank each person for attending, for their condolence gifts. Fresh fruit, flowers, fancy cards. Nothing in red, the Buddhist color of joy. They expressed their sympathies with empty words.
Based on the things that happen, it's just one tragedy after another, testing his faith, testing his sense of peace, testing his anger, and patience. How does he change?
We imagined that he changed by really drawing closer to his religion and following that belief system. That's reflected in his visit with a neighboring minister on the island of Oahu. It's also reflected in his continued writing of sermons while incarcerated. And then also in his artwork.
I love how you used artifacts in this book. You have letters, you have diary excerpts. The father is in a large part missing from the book. He's there with his letters that he writes sporadically. And he writes this letter to Ruby and her sister in 1939. I can't imagine, as someone who's just lost their mother, getting this note from the father.
November 23rd, 1939. My dearest daughters, your new mother and I are scheduled to arrive in Kauai on December 21. Her name is Teiko, and like me, she graduated from Ōtani University. She is a Buddhist priestess and managed a household of girls in her job as a school dormitory house mother. I believe her to be a suitable fit for our family. She looks forward to meeting you and helping me manage the temple and language school. We will celebrate the Christmas holiday together. Until then, continue to study hard in school, be obedient girls, and enjoy Thanksgiving. Love, Father.
This stepmother, however, is not the most pleasant person in the world. Many of the characters in viewing her think she's pretty damaged as a person. Would you talk about Teiko?
She really was, in real life, a pretty hard woman. On Ruby's way out of the kitchen, she overheard Teiko mutter under her breath, "Never have I experienced such unruly children." He said the girls were well behaved. No child of mine would behave that way. It's really hard as a writer when you're focused on a true story to move away from and let some things go. But we were willing to let some things go. We weren't quite sure how we were going to do it. In drafting that character, the assumption was, well, of course she's going to be the evil stepmother. we're getting input from critique readers and from a developmental editor that we worked with who warned us about, does the stepmother really need to be this evil? Is that a trope? Does she have some redeeming qualities? And it's something that we really struggled with. Ruby walked into the living room, repeating her stepmother's nasty words in her head. She was secretly glad to get out of the bean snapping and know her father would join them for supper. He had been spending many more nights out at meetings in the temple or at neighboring temples with other ministers and heads of the Japanese schools on the island. She thought about her stepmother's words. What if Teiko had a baby? Babies are innocent. Would Ruby be able to love Teiko's child as she imagined loving her baby sister who died? What if the baby killed Teiko, like the baby had killed Mama? Dark thoughts like that were too evil, even for Teiko, and Ruby pushed them from her mind. But what was revealed in our National Archives research came about in the stepmother's medical file. She had all kinds of medical conditions. There was a very extensive summary in there about the number of pregnancies she had suffered through. The pregnancies were all terminated. Eventually, she was so ill that they terminated the last pregnancy and then she was sterilized. That was the first time that I had that moment where, wow, this woman really suffered. She certainly didn't get what she signed up for, but she also then suffered all of these tremendous losses in her life. She was a complicated person.
Brad, if I could add a dimension to my step-grandmother, Connie and I were in California just last month. We visited and presented to the Buddhist congregation in Berkeley, where my grandfather was the Buddhist minister from 1950 to 1959. In presenting to the congregation, we learned from a handful of them who remembered her. They remembered her fondly. My step-grandmother would go to the temple, and she was a fixture in the community until her health turned for the worst. It was just interesting to go back, having written the book, spent so much time with the book, collaborating with Connie on the character, and then to hear these folks who knew her, as did I growing up as a kid. But these are older Japanese Americans who knew my step-grandmother from when she was a vibrant member of the community. So it was a bit of a contrast there, stepping out of fiction into the real world.
I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and you're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's listen as Constance reads about Ruby's father getting arrested in 1941, shortly after the bombing of Pearl Harbor.
As dusk settled, Ruby washed the dishes. Maddie nailed quilts over the windows, a temporary solution until they made blackout shades. Their father answered a knock at the door. Ruby dried her hands and stepped into the living room to see who was there. Her father greeted the sheriff, who was his friend, and two strangers wearing suits and ties, all three of them white men, and invited them inside. The sheriff's tone was serious. "Sensei, I hate to do this." The sheriff looked at the two strangers. "These men are with the FBI. We have a warrant for your arrest on suspicion that you are an enemy alien of the United States, pending final action by the Commanding General, Hawaiian Department, United States Army." Her father's angry voice quivered. "That's absurd. I've done nothing wrong. I'm as outraged by Japan's strike as you are, and I am not an enemy of the United States." One of the men pulled handcuffs from his pocket. "Turn around, sir." "Please," father said, stepping away from the door as they approached him. "I'm a Buddhist minister. We don't believe in killing." The sheriff put his hand on her father's arm. "Sensei, you must come with us. It's best." Father's heavy exhale filled the room with resignation, and he turned to put his hands behind him as instructed. Ruby flinched at the sound of the cuffs locking and felt the living room walls close in around her. Her father's watery eyes looked back at Teiko, but he seemed to avoid making eye contact with Ruby or Madi. "Don't worry, everything will be okay," he said. The men escorted her father out. "Where are you taking him?" Teiko demanded. Madi interpreted her stepmother's irate Japanese to English. The men didn't answer. Ruby ran to the open door and watched her handcuffed father disappear into the dark night.
A horrifying moment. They've frozen their assets, and then the father's just taken away, and he's gone. Give us a sense of what's happening in Hawaii at the time.
The hysteria was definitely widespread, and it was hysteria that culminated in the Executive Order 9066, which was President Roosevelt's executive order to intern or round up all the Japanese Americans, all the Japanese, mostly on the West Coast. The Japanese Americans on the islands of Hawaii were vital to the sugar industry, generating income for the economy there and likely for the mainland United States as well. The Japanese and Japanese Americans on Hawaii were not immediately arrested or relocated to detention centers, as they were euphemistically called, or evacuation centers. But the hysteria, as I mentioned, is probably not unlike the hysteria after 9/11 here in the United States and some of the other episodes that we've experienced in our lifetime. The distinction is that the Japanese Americans were all rounded up and identified solely on the basis of their race. If you had 1/12 Japanese blood in you, then you were subject to Executive Order 9066. So there it is, based solely on race. This hysteria resulted in folks like me today. If this were to happen today, 9066, then I would definitely have been subject to this, as would my children.
It was very difficult to leave the island and to go into the camps on the mainland. They had no way to support themselves. He was incarcerated, the temple was closed, and he had a wife who was from Japan who spoke no English. She was miserable. She didn't know anybody. She had left her entire support system in Japan, and she's raising these girls with no income.
Would you talk about your visit back to the camp and how you reconstructed the camp in Jerome?
The only thing that's there is a small cemetery, a marker, and the smokestack from where the hospital was. Back in this period of time, it was a small city on that farmland, and there were 35 blocks of barracks. And each block had 12 barracks. Each of those barrack buildings was separated by a number of apartments. And then in the center of each of those blocks was a women's and a men's washroom, lavatory, and a mess hall. Toward the front of the camp were the administration buildings, the school buildings. Somewhere within the camp, there were also churches, Buddhist temples, Christian churches, general stores where you could buy things or order from the Montgomery Ward catalog. Reconstructing the camp, we had to use our imaginations, relying on a lot of photography that was provided through the National Park Service, videos that we had watched from the museum materials, and maps.
My first visit to Arkansas, it was a work-related trip, and I went in a day earlier so that I could rent a car and drive down to Jerome. Because I was on a work trip, my state of mind was, I'm going to go see this. It's going to be factual. Several years go by. We write the book. To contrast that visit with the one from 8 years earlier, completely different. It was with the knowledge and the wisdom of having written the book, the feeling of greater respect for my parents and for all the Japanese Americans who were not only in Jerome or Rohrer, but in all the other 10 camps throughout the United States.
I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and you're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's return to our conversation with Kent and Constance Hayes Matsumoto about their book, Of White Ashes. This is another letter from the father, and he recognizes that the stepmother is just in great despair.
March 1, 1943. My dearest Teiko, it causes me great despair to hear of your unhappiness in Jerome. I believed a secure home within a larger Japanese population might raise your spirits. My requests to join you fall on deaf ears, and we can't know when they will reunite us. Until we are together again, please resist giving in to bitterness. None of this is our doing. The fault falls on two polarized governments, enemies of each other. We wouldn't have known any of these adversities would befall us. Thank you for your selflessness. You left everything familiar to you and the life you had built to marry me, raise my daughters, and help lead the temple. I trust you to make reasoned decisions for yourself and Ruby while we are apart, including your heartfelt wish to return to Japan and take her with you. Mari will be of age to decide for herself on her birthday later this month, but I imagine she too will accompany you. My grateful heart is yours, and until we meet again, we will close our eyes at day's end, knowing we are strong and the powers failed to break us. Please wish Ruby and Mari happy birthday for me. With devotion, Chico.
The stepmother has had enough. She decides, I'm going to go back to Japan. And she requests the individual request for repatriation.
The men busy themselves with paperwork. Blockhead pulled two forms from his drawer. The other asked and interpreted basic questions. Name, age, place of birth, family members, education. While Blockhead typed the responses. Unable to move, Ruby stared at her crossed arms. When Blockhead finished typing, he placed two completed applications in front of them. The form in front of Teiko was titled Individual Request for Repatriation. The form in front of Ruby was identical, except the man had crossed out repatriation with a series of X's and typed expatriation beside it. The interpreter showed them where to sign.
Ruby's eyes bulged, her muscles stiffened, her voice cracked. I'm not going to Japan. She's a cunny. She would not shut up. No, you can't force me. Teiko's backhanded slap across Ruby's face silenced her protests. The men showed no interest in the mother-daughter squabble. Blistering heat pulsed through Ruby's body. The impulse to bolt was irresistible, and she pushed her chair backward and ran out the building into the pounding March rain. She ran as fast as she could, slipping and sliding through the mud, past the open area, the schools, and the barracks, all the way to the fence line at the East Patrol Road on the far side of the camp.
Would you guys talk just a little bit about the hope in this book? As tragic a moment as it is in American history, I think there's resilience.
We do aspire for this book and your readers to engage in people's curiosity, to expand their knowledge, to want to learn more, importantly, to generate empathy for people who are different, and to remind readers of our whole world's fragility. And we'd like for readers to focus on what unites us rather than divides us, and we hope to do that one reader at a time. Connie mentioned the word gaman, which is the Japanese for enduring the seemingly unendurable with patience and dignity. That's our hope for the book. We hope is conveyed to readers, and we hope your listeners desire to learn more and to hopefully feel the same feelings that we felt as we wrote this and how proud we are of this work today.
We live in really difficult times. Our world is incredibly divisive. It's my hope that by reading about what it might have been like to be this young girl and experience the injustice that she experienced, or being this young boy who experienced the horrors of a nuclear bomb, that people will take that in, have empathy for what it might have been like for these people to experience that, and to maybe be a little bit more kind, a little more tolerant when approaching issues where people have differing viewpoints from them, and then taking steps toward peace.
I think this book is so prescient, and I hope that folks read it in a way as a cautionary tale, but also a tale of possibility.
It really is, and I couldn't have said it better. Thank you, Brad.
Brad, thank you, and thank you to Mary Ellen, your co-producer and wife there. We do share that as co-authors with the two of you, and very, very grateful that you've taken the time to feature our book.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. A big thank you to Mr. Spencer Kenny for the beautiful soundscapes and for producing, helping to mix, and for mastering the episode. Thank you to Mary Ellen Cubitt for the exceptional story editing advice. Generous funding for Arts and Letters was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to authors Kent and Constance Hayes Matsumoto for their informative and touching historical novel, which through its dignity, style, and grace, exemplifies the concept of gaman. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of Lois Lowry. The worst part of holding the memories is not the pain, it's the loneliness of it. Memories need to be shared. Arts and Letters Radio is a production of Living the Dream Media, Inc.